Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Konser. This week, Bill Dodge and I will take you back to April of 2006, when we were visited at the KBOO Studios by artist, author, professor, and creative coach Jessica Abel. Jessica was in town for the Wordstock Literary Festival, where she unveiled her epic graphic novel, La Perdida. Since this conversation first aired, Jessica has gone on to become the chair of the illustration department at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, and she's collaborated with her husband Matt Madden on a pair of textbooks, Mastering Comics and Drawing Words and Writing Pictures. While you're enjoying this vintage interview, we'd like to encourage you to take a moment, go online, and support community radio at kboo.fm. And now, Jessica Abel, recorded at the Wordstock Festival in Portland, April 2006. I'm S.W. Konser.
And I'm Bill Dodge. And along with literary legends like Dave Eggers and Gore Vidal, Jessica Abel is in town. Her comic book story, La Perdida, has just been collected into a hardcover book form from Pantheon Press. So welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thank you.
So tell us about the book. You've actually collected a whole bunch of comic books into one graphic novel, so it seems. Did this start out as a major graphic novel?
It was always conceived as a complete story. It was not an ongoing serial. It was a serialization of a graphic novel. So I knew that I would want to collect it when I'm finished.
And this is not necessarily a personal story, but there are definitely parts that come out of your experiences. You went down and lived in Mexico for a couple of years.
I did, yeah. I think it's misleading, though, to say that it comes out of my experiences because the story is really, really not autobiographical. It's completely fictional. And that is, it's a sticking point for a lot of people, which I am choosing to take as a compliment because it means that I'm doing a convincing enough story and writing characters well enough that people can't believe that they're not real. So I'm taking it as a compliment. But it is a little bit confusing that, you know, people assume that my father is Mexican, for example, which he's not. But it's a story that's set in Mexico City. There's a young woman named Carla who moves from Chicago to Mexico City. Her absentee father is Mexican, and so she imagines that she wants to look for some kind of new dimensions or depth or something in her history that will help her form an adult identity in some way. And as a result of some fairly serious misperceptions of the people who are around her, she gets in a lot of trouble.
Now, there's a strong undercurrent of politics, the Mexican-American relations, as well as how modern Mexican youth are understanding the American influence on their culture, which is not something everybody would expect in a mainstream comic.
I think that's true. I think it's not that common, and certainly certainly dealing with the relations between Mexico and the United States, that's not something that I see talked about in this kind of way very often in really any aspect of culture. It's one of the things that was really surprising me when I did move to Mexico was this feeling that I had no tools to think about it. It was all new to me. Yeah, it was really surprising.
There's a contrast in the book between two characters, one of whom wants to be invisible. He's the American expatriate who does not want to interact with the culture. And then the female lead in the book wants to lose herself in the culture. So did you call on experiences of people that you met and dealt with in the American community who kind of informed those characters?
Certainly, although I think both of those characters are exaggerations. They're not depictions of people I actually knew, but of positions that people took. So that I didn't know anybody like Carla, who's the protagonist of the book, who very foolishly ignores all the signs her brain is giving her because she thinks that everything must be different in Mexico and wants to just plunge into the culture and doesn't want to judge anything. And as a result, you know, makes misjudgments about people that she's with. Nor did I know anybody who was as completely divorced from the culture as Harry, her ex-boyfriend, is. So I kind of push things in both directions, you know, away from the center.
Maybe we should take some time to have you read from Perdida, if you'd like.
Sure. Okay, so I'm reading a section from La Perdida that's right at the beginning of the book when Carla arrives in Mexico City for the first time, and I apologize in advance for my Spanish accent. I arrived in Mexico 2 years ago today, February 23rd. What I was thinking when I decided to go, it's no longer at all clear to me. That is, I can remember, but it's like peering into the mind of a stranger. I had all these ideas and plans that seem now to be entirely based on misconceptions. Sus documentos, por favor. Your papers, miss. Oh, yeah. Of Mexico, of living abroad, of myself. I thought that I went because I was sick of the USA, sick of everybody. I wanted to find my Mexican roots. Somehow it seemed I would like them better than my Anglo ones, which makes no sense when you think about it. I'd spent most of my life resenting my disappearing Mexican dad. Señorita, taxi! No, no taxi. ¿Dónde está el metro? Señorita, déjame que le ayude con sus cosas. ¡Taxi, por acá! Está bien chida. ¿Ella? Pinches gringos locos. Se viste como mi abuelita y carga su mochila como si fuera un burro. ¡Qué coda! Ni pagar un taxi quiere. I didn't have money to speak of. A few $100s. I didn't have a resident visa. I had never been south of Kansas City. I just went. My ex-boyfriend, Harry, well, not my ex-boyfriend exactly, but my ex-something anyway. He had moved down 3 months before. When he left, it occurred to me, well, okay, to be honest, I knew before I met him that he was planning to move to Mexico. That was half the attraction. That's why I even got involved with him in the first place. I wrote him that I was coming for a visit, and he sent me brief and incomplete instructions on how to get to his house via metro and bus. I couldn't figure out the bus, though, and I had a map, so I walked. ¿De qué le damos? I looked closer on the map. Harry's not my type. I'm not into blonde, upper-crusty frat boys. It was the Mexico thing that intrigued me. It was a mystery why he would want to go, and that made me decide to meet him. I really hadn't thought of moving down there myself. I'm not his type, either. He doesn't go for crunchy ethnic wannabes. But the sex was good and strings-free since we both knew he was leaving. ¡Flaquita, yo te engordo! He hardly told me to get lost. In my email, I sort of implied that I would be staying just a few days. ¿Te lo dio cuando te caíste del cielo? Considering our previous relationship, I suppose he was like, okay, at least I'll get laid. What the hell? ¿De qué le damos, güerita? I didn't think about it then, but to be honest with myself, in the back of my mind, I think I planned it all along. El gos! To move in with him, I mean. Just that part. I had no money. He was a trustafarian. That was justification enough for me. It was so galling. His family had lived in Cuernavaca for a while when he was a kid, and they had a house in Puerto Vallarta, which means he had more connections to Mexico than I did, in a sense. Before I went down, a lot of people told me horror stories about Mexico City. Awful things that had happened to their friend's aunt's boss's son or something. I ignored it as best I could, though I was spooked when I first got there. I mean, there are probably a million VW Bug taxis in Mexico City, and I couldn't trust any of them. But when I saw Parque Mexico, I felt like I'd found the doorway to the part I recognized from my imagination, where the hard truth about the crime rate and the pollution and the disappearance of traditional culture just didn't apply. How can I explain it? You look at the facts, and it's not that special, really. Just a simple city park with some disused carnival rides in the middle. But at that moment, there was something magical. God, that sounds stupid. But that's how it felt. I had this immediate feeling that everything would be okay, that I would find the Mexico I was looking for, that it still existed. I'd never seen jacaranda before, and the jacaranda was blooming. Maybe that's the answer. The thing I really can't understand is, despite everything, the magic that that park possesses never disappeared. I should explain that this sequence takes place when she arrives at the airport. She's going out to
I love the part metro. Where taxi driver says she's dressed like my grandmother and carrying a pack big enough for a burro.
Yeah, wow.
It's very cute.
So that's the taxi stand. And then she gets on the subway. She heads out to Doctores, and then she walks across on Coahuila to Michoacán through La Roma into Condesa, and ends the sequence ends when she's in Parque Mexico in La Condesa. And I should also point out that this immediate feeling that she had that everything would be okay, she's wrong.
As we find out later.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of long tradition amongst hipsters, beats, alternative types to be expatriates, whether it's in Mexico or Europe. And the names William S. Burroughs, Jack Kerouac come up. Of course, Kerouac wrote Mexico City Blues, and there was an amazing part where Kerouac and company visit the character based on Burroughs and On the Road. Did you take the time to really read these books? I guess in a general sense, it just seemed like a good idea to mention that these Americans had really been deeply influenced by their time outside of the United States and changed them as artists.
Well, I can't testify that it did change them as artists because I have never read the books.
Okay, we won't hold that against you.
But. Yeah. No, I mean, I intentionally didn't read the books in some ways because especially not Kerouac so much, but especially Burroughs was this kind of presence in the journalist expat scene, you know, that we were acquainted with because he lived in the same neighborhood that a lot of us lived in.
Oh, I see.
So there would be a lot of discussion at parties or bars or whatever where it's like, did you know that Burroughs shot his wife in X building? You know, that there's a certain building that everybody knows where it is. And they're like, oh, yeah, I read about that in La Bala Perdida, which is this book in Spanish about Burroughs in Mexico. And somebody else will say, yeah, well, his house is gone, you know, but I went by the place that it was. It was kind of cool, whatever. Lots of lore gets passed back and forth.
Right.
And most of it wrong, you know? I mean, most of people's, it's very gossipy. It's not like and most of it isn't about the art. It's not about the literature. It's about the person. So, you know, there's a scene early in the book where some friends of Carla's are doing that. They're tossing around inaccurate information about Burroughs' time in Mexico. And the one person who knows anything about it is Harry, because he sort of idolizes those writers. But nobody else knows really anything about it. And they're just kind of like throwing out whatever they think they know. And that's what I was trying to get at. And if I'd known the real story, I wouldn't have been able to do it. So I sort of know the historical story now after having written this book and sort of doing the research about like what actually happened. But the literature is kind of beside the point because it's more about young expats who are there now trying to connect to this tradition of literary expats in Mexico City.
Did you tour outside Mexico City and see a different culture, a more indigenous culture?
Well, Mexico City, I think it's a mistake to think that it's not totally Mexican. There are almost no Americans there. You know, if you're talking population-wise, you never see tourists unless you're in, like, the, you know, Centro Histórico, right in the middle of downtown, looking at, you know, the cathedral and the Zócalo and stuff. You just never see him, which is interesting and cool. It's not like there's a lot of indigenous culture around, you know, meaning Native American, Central Americans. But it is a Mexican culture. And that's what is sort of weird about the expat community, because it very, very much sits outside of it and sort of isolated. At least this journalist community does, but it doesn't exert any influence on Mexico City in particular. There's also, of course, there are other ways to be an expat. Also, like being a business person, for example, we never encountered the American business community where we were in Mexico City. They would be living off in sort of a more gated kind of community type of thing, usually. So the people that we met were basically all writers and journalists. Or they weren't expats, they were immigrants, and they'd been living there for a really long time, and they were in the arts, or they were running restaurants. Like, they were people we met through our Mexican friends who are writers and intellectuals. And I don't pretend to say that this is an exhaustive, you know, an examination of the kinds of expats in Mexico, but certainly that's what I encountered.
I'm S.W. Conser, and you're listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, featuring artist and author Jessica Abel. Bill Dodge and I spoke with Jessica in April of 2006 while she was in Portland for the Wordstock Literary Festival.
Let's talk about where people can see and read about your work on the internet. What sites should we direct them to?
Well, mainly to my site, which is jessicaabel.com.
Can you spell that?
JessicaAbel.com. And that would be the main place to go. And then you can kind of go from there to other places. But I mean, anybody who wants to read about my work and read reviews and so on, if you Google me, there's a lot of good stuff there. And then my husband's site is, he's also obviously also a cartoonist, and his site is mattmadden.com, M-A-T-T-M-A-D-D-E-N. And also exercisesinstyle.com.
Yeah, he's written a book called 99 Ways to Tell a Story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, anybody should check that out. It's actually for a very general audience. It's great for kids. It's great for, you know, literature majors. It's great for everybody. It's actually called 99 Ways to Tell a Story, Exercises in Style. And it is inspired by Raymond Queneau's Exercises in Style, Raymond Queneau being the mid-last century French experimental writer and the founder of the Oulipo movement, which is an acronym that translates roughly as the Workshop for Potential Literature. And it's a really playful book that basically takes a one-page story that's very, very simple, and he redraws it 99 times in 99 different styles and approaches. So everything from points of view to genre changes to homages to, comics history to a chart to a map to whatever, just all kinds of things. And it's a charming, wonderful book. It's really great. And I would say that even if I wasn't married to him.
The great thing that's been going on the last few years, that comics are gaining a legitimacy in the United States and all over the world as, well, simply put, just another excellent way to tell stories. Mm-hmm. Just like what you were saying earlier, literature or cinema, they all are interrelated. It belongs in universities. It belongs in any other place that you would find so-called legitimate art, and it's not some bastard stepchild.
Right.
Maybe
I mean,
it was in the 30s.
Functionally, it has been a bastard stepchild.
Sure,
but,
sure.
But the basic concept of comics is you have words, which we all know are, you know, highfalutin, and you have pictures, which are also excellent and very cultural and everything. And you put them together, and you have the additional meaning created by the words plus the pictures. And you have the pictures next to each other, which can create all kinds of interesting frissons, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you look at what they really are, there's no justification for knee-jerk prejudice against the form. The knee-jerk prejudice comes all entirely out of the unfortunate history of comics in the last century, which has to do with, you know, it being shunted off to being for children, Senate hearings because it was for children, so it has to be dumbed down and, you know, all kinds of, it's not worth getting into, but the point being that for very good reasons, people assumed that comics were dreck for children, not even good for children. And I don't blame people in the past for having thought that, but what I do blame them for is not having an open mind about what the form can be.
Exactly.
Great practitioners of any form of art can make great art, but comics do have a great deal of subtlety at their disposal in that when you try to depict a relationship between people, you can do a lot of it nonverbally. You can depict this relationship in terms of the way people look at one another, how close they stand to one another, you know, the way they hold themselves as they're in a conversation with somebody. And all of that can be a really rich way of talking about the way people feel about each other. That technique is common to film, for example. Like, you can do the same kind of thing in film. Comics does other things that film doesn't do and so on, you know. But it's a really useful and very subtle technique.
And one of your early mini comics was Jessica Abel, Intrepid Girl Reporter, mm-hmm. which, even though you're a Chicago gal, moved to New York now, that was a very big seller here in Portland, and it was a collection of journalistic stories in comics form, things like
Camille Paglia.
Oh yeah, the Camille Paglia interview, for example.
And the Godzilla convention. So mostly pretty silly stuff. I mean, it's not really serious journalism. I have done a little bit of serious journalism. The Radio and Illustrated Guide that I did for This American Life, you know, is a fairly serious journalistic piece. But most of the stuff that I've done in journalism is pretty fluffy.
Well, it's kind of like something from, say, McSweeney's or the Harper's, just a short little bite of reporting of culture.
Yeah, but fluffy culture mostly. Mostly what I've done has been, you know, it's fun stuff.
What kind of comics were you reading as a young person? And what kind of materials do you use currently to create your comics?
I had a collection of 1940s Wonder Woman comics when I was little that was really awesome. I still have it. It's a really great book. Ms. Magazine put it out in the 70s. And when I got a little bit older, 87 was a big year for artists, you know, more author-driven comics. Mouse came out then. Right. That was pretty major. Also Watchmen. And then when I went to college, which was in like 87, I stumbled across Love and Rockets, which was really major for me. And then
it's
I also...
Hernandez Brothers.
Hernandez Brothers.
They're fantastic. Yeah.
It's amazing stuff. It's still coming out. I completely recommend it. And also, you know, I remember discovering Gary Panter and Julie Doucet and, you know, lots of other work that I still am very interested in.
So you and your husband, Matt Madden, are both instructors in cartooning at the School of Visual Arts. And your specialty is storytelling, a narrative form, which is a good thing for an English major from the University of Chicago. But tell us more about the SVA, the School of Visual Arts. A lot of graduates have come out that have been pretty celebrated in the mainstream comics world.
That's true, although the program that exists now is nothing like the program that people who you would be talking about went through. And basically, it was revised about 5 years ago by the current department head, Tom Woodruff, and is now an extremely rigorous program and is getting better all the time. So we have it's a great program. And there's a lot of really excellent faculty and the student body is amazing. There's such future stars coming through there. It's really fun.
Now, what would you find that's different from, say, a typical art school? What are some of the tricks of comic storytelling that you're trying to get across to these kids?
Well, I think the thing that everybody has to remember about comics is that it is a narrative art form. It's not similar to painting. You know, it's not in the same category as painting. It's in the same category as literature and film. It's a 4D art form in that sense, you know? So cartooning comics is an incredibly demanding art form where you have to master not only drawing at a basic level, just how to control the tools, you have to learn anatomy to some extent, even if you're working in a very cartoony style, you have to understand the basics of perspective, if not much more than the basics, depending on what kind of work you want to do, and understand more esoteric concepts such as panel transitions. So how do you go from one panel to another and what does it mean when you change points of view or, you know, things like that. So there's the purely visual, which is how to draw. Then there's the comics, which is panel transitions, page design. So there's a whole graphic design element to it. Deciding, you know, which involves deciding what size and shape panels should be, how large they should be. How much black or white or tone, or if it's in color, then you know what kind of color, what's the palette. All these things are design concerns to a certain extent, and then there's the narrative element, which is both visual narrative, so storytelling, as I spoke about earlier. You know, the idea of showing relationships between characters via the drawings of them and juxtaposing those drawings, and then also verbal storytelling. So you have to learn how to write. And this is actually probably one of the toughest things for art school students is, you know, they come in often with not very many writing skills. And as of yet, I haven't figured out how to teach this while I'm trying to teach everything else at the same time. So, you know, there's definitely issues with that. But it's like how to put together a sentence properly is at the basic level. But then also how do you think about story structure? What kinds of stories do you want to tell? I mean, just all the same things you have to think about in any other narrative form.
Yeah, that's got to be galling for an English major to be trying to get across basic English skills.
It's not galling. It's just sad because our educational system fails most students so badly in terms of being able to just construct sentences and construct arguments. It's like students have an idea for something. They have this desire to have a story be a certain way, but then they aren't able to actually mold that story or to even to understand their own desires for it because they don't have control of the words. They don't have control of the narrative. I mean, this is my job as a teacher is to help them work through this process, but a lot of it would be so much easier if they could just put their ideas down, their first ideas down in logical sentences, and then we can go from there. But, you know, actually I have to start from before that, which is like, okay, well, let's make it make sense first, and then let's work on making it better.
What kind of traditional materials are you getting your students to use, other than, I know it's pen and ink, but can you tell us specifically about certain tools that are used in these classes?
Well, just the same old tools cartoons have always used, you know, watercolor brushes, round watercolor brushes, mm-hmm. India ink, and steel nib pens.
You must see a lot of emerging trends in comics. And what's coming up that you think might be changing the narrative style or the artistic style of comics that might be leading the way in the coming years, the digital age?
The only major change in the last 10 years that I can see, and it is major, is the integration of the Eastern manga aesthetic into the existing American comics world. So there's a lot more diversity of style now among students. There are a lot more women studying comics because they were reading comics as younger people. But I mean, in school, they're mostly doing traditional comics pages. You know, they're drawing them on Bristol board, and some of them have web pages and they have web comics. But no, we want everybody to be drawing, you know, with pens or brushes and grapple with traditional materials so they can, you know, expand their horizons. And some of them will decide eventually to ink everything digitally. I hope they don't, but one or two of them doing it would be fine, as long as it's not everybody.
Now, you live in Brooklyn now, and apparently there's quite an up-and-coming comics community. There has been a lot of interaction between New York cartoonists, but you say it's really coalescing very well in the recent years since you moved there about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, there have always been many, many cartoonists in New York, partly just because it's New York, but partly also because the main superhero comic book companies are there. Marvel and DC are there, and so lots of people, you know, work there or whatever. And of course, SVA's always been there, so grads will, you know, tend to be in New York at least for a while. But sometime around the early 2000s, there was this new feeling of energy in the New York comic scene, and the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art has started having an art festival every year. You know, it's a comics convention, but for the authors of comics rather than for comics companies. So it keeps things energized.
You've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in April of 2006, and featuring author, artist, professor, and creative coach Jessica Abel. Jessica was in Portland for the Wordstock Literary Festival, where she unveiled her graphic novel, La Perdida. I'm S.W. Conser, joined by Bill Dodge. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter, @WordsAndPicture. Before we go, I'd like to remind you that your community radio needs your support more than ever. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm.